We have been talking for the past few weeks about the prophets of the Old Testament. And the purpose in our doing so is to recognize that the prophets are not so much predicting the future as they are speaking to us about what God needs us to know about God. I encountered in my reading this past week, a colleague of mine was talking about the prophets, and he said, you know, we have this notion that the most important faith question for us is, if you die tonight, where will you be tomorrow? But for the prophets, that's not the most important faith question. For them, the most important question is this: if you don't die tonight, where will you be tomorrow? Where will you be tomorrow in serving God, in following Christ, if you don't die tonight? Pointing out what God's values are and encouraging us to integrate God's values with our lifestyle. That's the work of the prophets. And integrate is the verb, integrity is the noun. So when God's values are integrated with our lifestyle, we live with integrity. That's the purpose of what we're speaking of with the prophets over these several weeks in the summer. Today we turn to Hosea. We don't hear much about Hosea, but his work was incredibly important. Hosea did more than any of the other Old Testament prophets to set the stage for Jesus, so that we recognized when Jesus came, we recognized his ministry and his work and his identity. The 11th chapter of Hosea is one of the most remarkable and beautiful passages in all the Scripture, but I have to set the stage for you before I read these 9 verses to you. This is a conversation that God is having with God. God is having a conversation with himself, in fact, an argument with himself. And so what Hosea portrays here is some contention that God is experiencing within himself. And I'm going to try to read it in a way that you can sense what the discussion, that the argument that God is having with himself is all about. As I do that, though, there are 3 terms that, because this is Old Testament, I want to be sure you recognize them. The first of all, Hosea begins by talking about Israel. And then he uses the term Ephraim, the name Ephraim. Ephraim was one of the tribes of Israel, one of the grandsons of Jacob. Ephraim was the largest and most prominent tribe. So when Hosea speaks of Israel and Ephraim, it means the same thing. Ephraim is another word for Israel or for the nation Israel. So when you hear Ephraim, he's talking about Israel. And the second pair of words are the names of 2 towns, Adma and Zeboiim. Probably never heard the names of those towns before, but they were neighbors of, those 2 towns were neighbors of 2 towns whose names you have heard, Sodom and Gomorrah. And Adma and Zeboiim were 2 towns that were destroyed at the same time Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. So when you hear those 2 names in this passage, you'll know what they mean. Hosea chapter 11. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. The more I called him, the more he went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and offering incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness and bands of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them. They shall return to the land of Egypt, and Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The swords rage in their cities, consuming their priests and devouring them because of their schemes. My people are bent on turning away from me to the Most High they call, but I will not raise up to help them at all. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and no mortal, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come to you in wrath. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I've given him a chance three times now, and three times he has let me down. I'm not going to be generous anymore. I've had it. I don't want to get burned again. Those words came from a man named Douglas. Douglas was a man who was willing to go, usually willing to go a second mile. He was known for his good nature and his kindness and his willingness to give a person a chance. But in this case, he had gone as far as he could go. Douglas was a carpenter, and he had a small contracting firm. Against his better judgment, he had hired a man named Sandy to work for him. Sandy was a good worker, but he was not always dependable. When Doug needed him and depended on him for a Monday morning roof job, Sandy never showed up. He had had too much of a weekend, you know. After a reprimand, Doug gave him another chance. But it happened again. And then it happened a third time, and then it was then that Doug said to Sandy, I've given you three chances now, and that's enough. I'm not giving you any more chances. I'm sorry, but I have to let you go. You may know someone like that, someone who's not performed well and been let go, or perhaps you've been one who has had to let someone go because they haven't fulfilled their promises to you. You may have experienced some version of that story yourself. When someone takes advantage of you, when someone makes you a promise and then does not perform their duty, you may be willing to forgive them once or twice or maybe even three times, but usually, eventually, you get to the point where you say, that's enough. I don't want to go through this again. I can't afford to do this any longer. That feeling of exasperation and disappointment and anger, we're all familiar with. You've bent over backwards to give a person a chance, but that person has failed to do his or her part. Well, that's where God is when we encounter God in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. That's what God has gone through, and that's what God has experienced. Instead of a contractor and an undependable worker, however, we have a picture of a father and a son who is undependable. The son chooses to disregard everything his father has done for him, everything that he has taught him, everything that he's given him. In fact, this son seems bent on his own destruction, and there's nothing that the father or anyone else can do, and the father laments. Remember the first words? When Israel was a child, I loved him. I saved him out of slavery in Egypt. But the more I called to him, the more he went the other way and sacrificed to Baals and burned incense to idols, lived by values that weren't my values, did things that were contrary to what I'd taught him. Hosea talked about those things in his 11th chapter. And he explained to us something that was new in Israel. Now, it's not new to us, so we tend to take it for granted. But something was new that Hosea was saying. He was saying to the people, the covenant that we have with God, the covenant that God has made with us, is not so much a covenant of law as it is a covenant of love. Before Hosea, when people talked about God's covenant, they used words like law and righteousness and judgment and punishment. But Hosea came along and he changed all of that. And he made it so that the words associated with God's covenant with us are faithfulness and patience and love, trustworthiness and forgiveness. Once the analogy of our relationship to God was, it was a covenant between a king and his subjects, a contract, if you will, between a ruler and those who are ruled. But Hosea changed the analogy. The covenant we have with God is more like the covenant between a husband and a wife, more like the covenant we have between a parent and a child. Hosea was the first prophet to have the courage to say that and to frame this matter of covenant not as a matter of law, but as a matter of love. And it was a tremendously important transition in our faith and for our faith. Hosea was the first prophet who had the courage to say that. The covenant, he said, is we have to look at it as if God is married to Israel. He talks about it that way in the first and second chapters of Hosea, where Israel is like a wife for God. It is like God is married to Israel, and Israel is the unfaithful wife, the one who runs away from her marriage. When that happens, a husband has a right to get rid of his wife, and most husbands would do that, and you wouldn't blame them. But that's the image that Hosea used in the first two chapters, the image of a faithless wife. And Hosea is actually, when he does that, he's actually reflecting on his own marriage to a woman named Gomer. His wife ran off on him. She ended up in a life of prostitution, and she sank so low that she sold herself into slavery. And Hosea then, you know what he did? He went to the slave market and he bought her back. He bought her. In essence, Hosea redeemed his wife. And that's where it is with the prophet Hosea that concept of redemption, of buying someone back, someone who has fallen into sin and depravity, you purchase them back. That idea of redemption entered Hebrew thought with Hosea. And of course, that's what I meant when I said earlier, it enabled us to recognize Jesus and Jesus' work when he came among us because of what Hosea talked about. So Hosea bought back his wife out of slavery, and Hosea tells us that God is like that. We, our nation, Israel, is like Gomer, who has run away and worships other gods. But God has bought us back. You would expect that God would give up on us because of our sins, that God would finally have reached the limit of his patience. I've forgiven you once, twice, three times. Now I've had enough. I can't go through this anymore. But God buys us back, redeems us. And here is the new insight. God will not abandon Israel. God will always be faithful to God's promise. God has given us a promise, and God will be faithful no matter what. And this we call covenant. God is in covenant with us. God always keeps God's promises. That is, in the first two chapters of Hosea, he says God is like a spouse who is faithful even though his partner in the marriage is not. But in our text this morning, in the 11th chapter, Hosea is talking about the same thing, but he changes the metaphor. No longer is he talking about husband and wife, but he's talking about father and son, parent and child. And in that 11th chapter, God carries on a kind of a soliloquy. I think that it's from the 11th chapter of Hosea that Shakespeare got the idea of soliloquy and learned how to do it. God is within his own mind, weighing what he should do with this child, torn between the behavior of the child, which is reprehensible, and the feelings that only a parent can have. When Israel was a child, I loved him. I bought him out of slavery in Egypt. The more I called him, though, the more he went from me. Yet it was I am the one who taught this child to walk. I took him up in my arms, even though he doesn't remember that it was I who healed him. That's the parent talking. How many of you parents can remember your children and what a joy it was to watch your child with gentle encouragement, how they take their first steps and they begin to walk, beginning to venture out on their own? There's hardly anything more joyful than that time. Your child doesn't remember it, but you remember it, and you'll never forget. I taught Ephraim to walk, God says. I have loved this child into life and cared for this child, and this child's ability to walk and move about on his own is because of the love I gave him. That's a bond that is never broken. Or perhaps you remember, like I do, and so many of us parents do, the time when our child got so sick and a frantic ride through town to the emergency room in the middle of the night. How many of you have done that? Holding that child so close, trying to ease their fear and their pain. My child doesn't remember that now. He doesn't remember that sickness and that hospitalization and that surgery. But I'll never forget. And his mom will never forget. And God says, I took them in my arms and carried them, but they don't remember it was I who healed them. How can I give you up, my child? God says, how can I hand you over? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy my own child, for I am God, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come to destroy you. Covenant. This is what covenant means in Israel and to us. You read Hosea and you see that God is determined to keep his promise. That's what covenant means. God always keeps God's promise. This is the center and the heart of biblical faith, this matter of covenant. God always keeps God's promise. If you take the Bible and you boil its message down to one phrase, that would be it. God keeps the promise. That's what biblical faith is about. And if you want to define the essence of faith according to the Bible, essence of faith for us, it is this. We trust that God will keep the promise. We trust that God keeps God's promise. And life is difficult because it doesn't always look like God keeps the promise. It doesn't always look that way. And that's why it's called faith and not certainty. Because there are times when we walk by faith, trusting the covenant, trusting that God keeps God's promise, even though it doesn't look like it. A colleague of mine told me that he was speaking about these things in a sermon at one point and talking about how dependable God is and how God keeps the promise. And he said, after the service, one man walked out the door and shook his hand and he said, "What about Auschwitz?" And he just kept going. And you know, I have shown you before that I keep three stones near my desk, one of them has an A on it, and it has an A on it because this stone came from Auschwitz, in Eastern Germany, or is it in Poland now? I can't keep the border straight. And this little stone has a B on it, and it came from Birkenau, another one of those concentration camps where millions of people died. And this third one has a T on it. It came from Treblinka, another one of those places. And I keep these near my desk. And my colleague said, you know, when that man walked out the door and said, "What about Auschwitz?" He said, "I'm glad he kept walking." He didn't wait for an answer because he said, "You know, I don't have an answer for that." And I keep these stones near my desk to remind me that I don't have all the answers either. That when I look around at my congregation, at my nation, at the world in which I live, I don't have all the answers for some of the things that people do and some of the things that we say to each other and some of the things that go on and the course of events, I don't have all the answers. And I don't pretend to. These stones help me remember that I don't have all the answers. And I don't need to have all the answers, because the Bible doesn't have all the answers. If anyone comes up to you, anyone who is a Christian, and claims that they know it all, they have all the answers, they know why things are happening the way they are and what's going to happen in the future, they're trying to draw you into their own delusions. Nobody has all the answers. The Scripture doesn't have all the answers. We're not expected to have all the answers. The Bible doesn't have all the answers. And faith is not about having all the answers. Faith is about trusting that God keeps the promise. God always keeps the promise. No matter what it looks like now, no matter what the course of events is, no matter where you are and what you're experiencing, God keeps the promise. Trusting that God keeps God's promise is the work of faith. I spent some time a few years ago with a colleague. Her mother had just died, and she was struggling with her faith and with her prayer. She said, "I prayed that my mother would live, but she suffered greatly and then she died. I struggle to believe now and to pray because my prayers weren't answered then. I couldn't answer her either. Her prayers were not answered in the way that she wanted them to. The only thing I could tell her was, God keeps the promise. I know God keeps the promise. And right now, it doesn't look like God keeps God's promise. It doesn't look like that at all when you've just lost your mother or your father or your child or your friend. It doesn't look like that. But God keeps the promise. Keeping that faith and trusting God is what Christian life is all about. I don't have all the answers all the time. I do have some answers sometimes. I don't want you to think that I'm completely dumb. I don't have all the answers all the time. None of us do. And Christian faith is not about having all the answers all the time. Faith is more about having courage to go on without the answers, trusting the covenant, trusting that God keeps God's promise, that God is faithful and calls us to the same faithfulness. That's the challenge of Christian life. To trust God and to imitate God so that we are faithful as God is faithful. Perhaps you heard on the news this past week the story of the tragic train accident in Northern Maryland, where I believe it was 9 people who were killed, if that number hasn't gone up since the last news story I heard. One train overtook another one on the same track, and the warning sensors to prevent such a thing were not working. Well, when I heard that story, it reminded me of another train accident I heard about. It must have been 25 years ago, but it happened in Harrisburg. And the story was very much the same, where one train overtook another. A passenger train had stopped on the tracks and was waiting to enter the Harrisburg area and the train station in Harrisburg. That train was stopped, and then a freight train came along behind it and ran into the back of that passenger train. The engineer of the second train escaped death by leaping from the engine just before the collision. Well, after that accident, there was, of course, an investigation. And as they investigated, they found no mechanical problems with the trains themselves or with the signals or with the tracks. And as they continued the investigation, more and more their investigation centered on the engineer of the second train and what had happened that had caused that engineer to run into the back of a train. And as they continued to ask questions and look at things, they discovered that there was, on the tracks north of the city, there was a signal man. There was a man with a signal flag waving a red flag. And the red flag means you're to stop. And so they asked the engineer, "Why did you not stop when you saw the signalman waving the red flag?" And the engineer said, "I saw the man waving the warning flag. Then why didn't you stop? I saw him. But the flag was yellow. It wasn't red. And yellow means slow down rather than stop. I saw the flag and it was yellow, so I thought he just wanted me to slow down." Then they went and examined the flag. Well, the flag was red at one time, but it had been weathered by the sun and the rain so that the red had washed out and it appeared to be a dirty yellow color. The faded flag, the flag had lost its fidelity, its true color, and tragedy resulted. That's the danger for us. And that's Hosea's warning for us, that we lose our fidelity, our true color, that we lose our ability to trust in God's faithfulness. We Christian disciples and we as a community of faith often falter and fail at the love to which we are called. We equate faith with having all the answers instead of trusting God even when there aren't any answers. The prophet calls Israel, Hosea calls God's people to the task of faithfulness. He does so in the context of God's unfailing, long-suffering, faithful love for all God's people. God keeps the promise no matter what, and we call that covenant. And faith is trusting God to keep the promise, even when it doesn't seem to be so. Many times in the church, when we sing hymns on Sunday morning, and I have to confess to you that hearing this congregation sing is one of the things that keeps me coming back here. I love to hear you sing, and we're going to sing one of your favorites in just a moment. But I want you to know something about this hymn, "Great is Thy Faithfulness," before we sing it. Oftentimes, the hymns that are in our book have been written by the authors out of a time of crisis. Something has happened in their lives that causes them to lean more heavily, more intentionally on God. And out of that experience, they write a verse which becomes a hymn. But that's not the case with "Great is Thy Faithfulness." Thomas Chisholm was struck by the morning, by morning, by morning faithfulness of God. And you'll hear that in the words of his hymn. Thomas Chisholm realized that God is trustworthy and dependable, reliable, faithful every day, day after day. When the days are wonderful good and when the days are trying and tragic, God is faithful. And so he wrote this hymn to remind us and to keep us trusting that God keeps the promise. God keeps the covenant. "Great is Thy faithfulness." I know it's one of your favorites, and you never disappoint me when you sing it.